Hey everybody, this is Tom Lynn coming to you today again from my vehicle. Apologies for the informality of the context, but we're here with the great Tim Benson, whom I know from way back in the way back. Tim, when I knew him, we were both students at Xavier University, and Tim went on to have a career as a musician and maker of bagpipes, but had sort of shifted, pivoted in his commitments, and has an interesting, well, I was going to say forthcoming, but it's just out, book, The New Eon, Analysis of the Universal Field of Consciousness, I believe is the title. And we're just going to be sort of spitballing about that today and go from there. The thing which I think maybe this distinguishes Tim from some of the other people we've had on this the channel is that there is a kind of note of optimism in some of his analysis. Now that there is an optimism in other quarters, with some of my other guests, but it's coming from a somewhat different perspective. But that's enough by way of prologue, Tim. Why don't I turn it over to you? And if you want, you can just sort of maybe we could just open by a recapitulation of major things that you're trying to communicate with this text, this
Okay,
book.
sure. Well, thank you for having me on, Tom. It's really I'm so glad we reconnected. I wish we could meet in person. Hopefully one of these days we can, but I really value the time that we spent together in Cincinnati. I've never quite met anybody that was quite like Tom, and
No,
it's quite an honor to be asked to be on his program here.
that's very kind. So,
Anyway, well,
maybe not.
I'm still working on sort of like summarizing, being able to summarize the book at will, because it is a radical book, and it's difficult for me to put it into words exactly what happened, and unless I just basically start from the beginning. I engaged in a course of personal spiritual aspiration, which included meditation, time-honored techniques, contemplation, prayer, group work, spiritual inventory, et cetera, and I did not expect to do really. I had ambition that I was going to achieve some state that I was studying about, because my will was just so hyper totally focused on achieving some sort of higher consciousness, to the point where it really became I came, became ultra focused, and so I wasn't expecting to make any major discoveries or to encounter anything that was mind-boggling. I started using a consciousness research technique that came about in the 1990s. It was sort of developed in kinesiology and psychiatry, where they were testing various stimuli, the response of musculature to all kinds of different stimuli. And psychiatry was the first place where they started to measure, emotional content, emotional stimulus, musical stimulus, art, to the effects on the deltoid muscles. So, I mean, basically, what it involved was somebody putting their arm out, another person presenting some stimulus, and then pressing in the arm to see if the arm stayed firm and strong, or if it sunk under an equal amount of pressure and became weak. And so, there were, you know, a handful of doctors that were working with this technique in the 1970s. In the 90s, a psychiatrist came along by the name of David Hawkins, who refined the technique further. He discovered that the technique could be used to discern truth. So he would do basically, you know, the basic, instead of presenting stimuli that was, you know, like music or things like that, he did basic statements and declarative questions that had a basic yes or no answer. And what he found was that things that were, you know, objectively true, like the temperature or the day of the week, the body responded in an absolute way, yes or no, to the truth. So he wrote about this book and published it in, I think, the late 90s, called Power Versus Force. And he outlined the entire technique and all the parameters of employing it in a way that was led to the most accurate results. So I, on a daily basis, started to use this technique, mostly out of curiosity. I had seen it work for him, and I was curious about employing it in my own life. I had no idea what the implications of using it was going to be and how powerful it was going to be to transform my life, transform my relationships, etc. Do you have a question?
I do have a question. I would just, then maybe I can hold it if you like, until you're done. Or you can hold it. You don't have to answer right away, but by way of clarification, there's, you know, the truth of a statement, and then there's the manner in which a person perceives that statement. So if you say to someone, you know, say someone really thinks it's Wednesday when in fact it's Thursday, you know, it's just a genuine good faith misconception, and you say to them, it's Wednesday, is their musculature going to exhibit an affirmative response despite the fact that it's in fact Thursday? In other words, do you see what I'm driving?
Yes.
Does this procedure seem to obtain results consistent with the truth and or falsehood of a proposition, regardless of the subject's personal perception of what the truth or falsehood of that proposition might be?
The answer is yes. So
that is a remarkable consideration, because it indicates that the body has a sense of the truth, which is independent of the, I don't want to say independent of the mind, but independent of the sort of, at least an aspect of the person's individual consciousness.
The body expresses the truth as it is in consciousness, and the what David Hawkins called the universal, omnipresent, omniscient field of consciousness, the holistic field that exists in the universe, the universal field of consciousness. So that is the holistic entire expanse of consciousness that everybody has some aspect of. Now that is filtered down through the ego and through one's conditioning and through repressed emotions, all that, but it exists in each person at a fundamental level as the fundamental self with a capital S, you know, it's the right thing that you is listening to me talk right now. And it's the thing that's speaking through my voice. It's the thing that's perceiving the conversation, the field in which the conversation is taking place. There's not really two individuals here. There's only one consciousness, and it's registering through different sort of positions, I suppose. But even the positions would be illusory from the highest perspective. So in regards to the test, if you will, the objective field of consciousness, the universal field of consciousness, That is where the truth resides, and the truth is accessible regardless of belief systems, opinions, thoughts, emotions of the person, the test subject onto which you are doing the test, and the tester themselves. So really, any two people anywhere in the planet can confirm the same truth, or they can reveal the same falsehood anywhere at any time, as long as they follow a very simple protocol. The first and most important protocol is asking permission from the field. The second is asking is, well, it's, this isn't an actual requirement, but it's one that I adopted early on, and that was to confirm that my motive and my intention for asking the question calibrated, that it had integrity, that it was not a self-serving question. One of the observations that Hawkins made was that the question is coming from the ego, from one's self-serving motives, from a motive of resentment or personal gain, it voids the entire accuracy of the results, which is fascinating. Of course, I, you know, being human, made a few false positives in the beginning, but I adopted the approach of asking, you know, I would ask permission, you know, I have permission to ask this question, resist, the arm goes strong, I proceed to the next question. My motive for asking this question calibrates over 200, which is the threshold of truth on Hawkins's scale of consciousness. And if I got a strong response to that, well, then I would proceed. So those are the two big requirements. There are others too, that have to do with, potential imbalances in the chakra system and the acupuncture system. For instance, it's recommended to take your glasses off if you are a test subject. People with tattoos might have to do a breathing exercise to clear certain chakras out before they do the test. Certain belief systems that are associated with the denial of absolute truth void the person as a test subject. That sort of goes counter to your first question, which I actually don't understand why, but this was something that Hawkins found out. If the person in their consciousness denied the reality of absolute truth, they were not an ideal test subject, because the power of that negativity threw off the test. And I suspect that it was related to the flow of Kundalini through the chakra system. So the body itself is the tool, and consciousness registers through the body, through the acupuncture system, through the chakra system. If that is somehow distorted or not, there's some blockage there, the test subject is not going to get accurate results. So there are breathing exercises you can do, but if you're a nihilist who doesn't believe in that there's any objective or absolute truth, then that is a powerful belief system, and it throws the test off. So that is not an ideal test subject for the test. There are other requirements that, if you want to know more about them, you can study the appendices of Dr. Hawkins' work.
Right. I do find it interesting that the perception of truth to have a relative character interferes with the reliability of this process that you're describing. I'm just wondering what the, we don't have to linger too long on that point, right? It turns on, because there are relativities. It seems that is an un, I think that that in itself is a true statement, right? There are culturally relative assertions, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a truth, an absolute truth per se. It's more that our modes of perception regarding that absolute truth are tied to specific contexts. We can never actually apprehend the truth in its totality. We can only approach it from limited facets or vectors. So, like, for example, to take a very pedestrian illustration, you can look at an apple. You can never see the entirety of the apple, right? You see the apple, but in fact, you only see one side of the apple. And you touch the apple, you only touch like a segment of it. You never completely encounter the entire apple, okay? Right? That doesn't mean there isn't a truth to the apple, but your perception of the apple is relative to a bounded vantage. Consequently, even if the truth is absolute, or even if there's something like an absolute truth, we seem to be occupying a structure of apprehension, of understanding, of cognition, of access that will only have the ability to glean partial or relative facets of that absolute quality. So, given that circumstance, a question is raised as to its implications for the test, where what is the perspective implicit in the test that gives a kind of ratification of its results as deeply true. Because in other words, the test seems to be taking a particular orientation toward these propositions. Why is this orientation privileged over, say, the orientation of a person who is perhaps not a nihilist, but kind of an agnostic regarding the relativity of truth?
Well, those are two very different belief systems. Agnosticism says, I don't know. Nihilism says, I know. So there's a humility in agnosticism that is lacking, perhaps, in atheism or nihilism. And they, to me, would be expressions of an emotional state that was associated with depression, with a lack of meaning, with a certain state of being that was inherently negative. But I think the truth is, I don't understand why that is. Why, if let's say that you're an atheist, which would imply that there's a denial of absolute truth there. There's no, or a nihilist.
Let's use the word nihilist because atheism is a little trickier.
Sure, I think so. So you can, let's just say you're a nihilist and you deny that there's absolute truth. I'm not sure what it is, Tom. I think.
Sorry, go on.
Dr. Hawkins might be able to comment on that. He died in 2012, so that's probably not going to happen. But I would suspect it has something to do with throwing off the acupuncture meridians, throwing off the flow of Kundalini through the chakra system. There's a chakra called the third eye, which is the chakra related to discernment. And I know that certain belief systems would definitely hamper the upper chakras, the crown and the third eye. And maybe that is why they cannot perform the test, because the flow of Kundalini through their physical body is not sufficient to produce a test that is reliable and that is consistent. You know, there are other there. This is I think this is probably the answer. Another case where the person would not be able to be a test subject and get accurate results would be if they were inhabited by an extremely negative energy field, which I talk about in the book called an astral entity, where there's a very, very specific bodiless personality that comes and goes out of their consciousness that's extremely negative. It would be the equivalent of a coarse illustration of this would be somebody with multiple personality disorder, so that they have some sort of an entity that is not them that comes and goes. In fact, in psychiatry, people who have multiple personality disorder, two personalities will have different health conditions. They're not even aware of each other.
Right.
So if somebody had an otherwise normal personality that was not disturbed and that was, basically like our two personalities now, there isn't a whole lot of emotional negativity going on between yourself and myself. If some entity of that type entered from the astral domain of consciousness, which is a part of the human overall universal field of consciousness of humans, it would throw the test off too. And I've actually experienced I've actually experienced this with a person who was agitated under the surface, who was harboring an energy of this sort and getting false positives. Testing Hitler's energy got a positive result. Testing Bin Laden and Pol Pot will give you positive results when the person has an astral entity of that nature.
Okay, that's fascinating. Because really, it sounds like you're just so it seems it'd be salutary maybe to take a step back, a few steps back, and add some clarifying remarks in connection with the vocabulary that you're using. And one can follow it, not too much difficulty, but it'll probably still be good to flesh things out. It does sound like there are presuppositions that go into the process. And one of those presuppositions seems to be that the body is constituted by whether the body, the person is constituted not just by a body, but by a set of energetic systems. And the perception of, or relationship, let's say the relationship with the true, seems contingent upon these energetic systems being arrayed in a particular manner. So when you talk about the Kundalini and the chakras, this is a vocabulary which is borrowed from predominantly Indian traditions, I believe. But that's almost an accident of naming, right? You're like, well, you know, a similar but distinct system derives from China, where, you know, the meridians and so forth. In fact, they're not identical. The Chinese mappings, if you like, of the human energy system are not coincident with the mappings that we get from the Indian system. That's not to say that they're mutually exclusive, right? The point is that there's an underlying energetic physiology, which is broadly which has broadly been dismissed by the Western tradition from, not entirely, but broadly been dismissed from the dominant strands of the Western tradition, modernity forward. This process that you are describing, in which you have been employing, is actually wanting to forward or foreground the importance of these energy systems. Is that correct?
Indeed.
The other thing here is that you're positing an additional non-visible domain that you've designated as the astral domain, which itself is inhabited by various other kinds of entities. It sounds to me, and I, none of this stuff bothers me, but some people will get their panties in a bunch about it. But to use a somewhat so it sounds to me like you're positing something like a level of possession.
Yes, I didn't use that word in the book. I did use the word host to describe the person's consciousness who would be inhabited by an entity of that sort. So I use the word inhabited, but not possessed, because it has a sort of religious occult baggage that goes along.
Of course, there are other kinds of possession too. So shamanic tradition sort of invites, if I understand those traditions correctly, a shamanic tradition will invite an entity into the shaman, and generally the entity is going to have a more positive character to it. And then you have sort of an intermediate case with people who are mediums that channel potentially people who have passed away or other kinds of beings or what have you.
Yep.
All right. So that I don't know if you want to expand on that in terms of clarifying your relationship with that vocabulary and so forth.
Sure. Before this entire phenomenon of the new eon and the unfolding of a higher energy field in the universe, before any of that came up for me, one of the principles that I lived by in my spiritual life was to avoid at all costs the occult, the astral realm, talking about it, investigating it, because the teaching that I was operating under seemed to say that not that those realms don't exist, but that we're not equipped as ordinary humans to interact with that realm and to investigate it, although people did, that there were destructive forces there that posed as positive, even spiritual avatars, Jesus Christ, for instance, Indian gurus from the past that would manipulate people only to lead them down a path that was negative and destructive. So anyway, so I avoided the entire question until I got involved in the new eon work. That what I found was that the astral realm is an aspect of human consciousness. It's human consciousness is organized in a strata. So you have etheric consciousness, which would be the higher spiritual consciousness that we all is our higher nature, the true self, the higher self. And there's the realm of the ego. Then there's the astral realm, which is a place in human consciousness that is largely unexplored. And really, since the intellect has basically dominated Homo sapiens for 5,000 years, it's sort of been put off to the wayside in favor of reasonable, rational thought. The astral realm came into being 1.4 million years ago in Homo sapiens. It was heavily influenced by the collective ingestion of psychoactive plants in nature. That, you know, 1.4 million years ago was about the time that Homo sapiens started to have abstract thought for the first time. And it coincided with and was augmented by the large-scale consumption of psilocybin and other hallucinogens that they ate as part of their hunter-gatherer diets. Now, that around that time, first rational thought in humans was being also influenced by the fact that they were still animals and that they had predatory instincts. So some of the humans that were influenced by predatory instincts attacked other humans. And I don't know if you read the chapter on the astral realm in the book. Did you read it, Tom?
No, I went through the website and the excerpt and whatnot, but I haven't had an opportunity to go through the book itself.
This was just a realm of consciousness. It was the repressed phantasmagoria that exists in all of our minds, that is really was sort of supplanted by reason, and by the ego. A lot of people experience astral consciousness all the time, but it's repressed, it's pushed down, it's not part of our waking consciousness most of the time. Some people experience it in dream sleep. They actually enter the astral realm in an astral body. And, you know, children who have dreams where they're all of a sudden they come to their parents and say, I was out in the backyard last night. And the parent says, what are you talking about? Yeah, in the middle of the night, I was out in the backyard and I was walking around and I could see everything. And then I came back to my body in my bed and I woke up and the parents can't explain that. Well, the child went into their astral body during sleep and you're able to travel in the astral domain during sleep. And a lot of people have experienced that. But the original formation of the astral realm in terms of it being inhabited by entities happened 1.4 million years ago during the first predatory attacks of Homo sapiens on other Homo sapiens. And what happened was they dissociated from their physical form in order to survive the trauma of violence.
So go on.
So over millennia, the astral realm is sort of like a traumatic reservoir of negative experiences, negative emotions, experiences that have been informed by psychoactive drugs, and human consciousness has created entities, literally entities, in the mind that inhabit this realm of consciousness. And we call those astral entities.
I see.
Up until, do you have a question?
I have lots of questions, but I want you to sort of finish your excursus, as it were.
Right.
Your summary.
Well, up until the eon shift, the objective negativity in reality, we'll say, which we talked about over the phone, that you had made the remark that you thought that there were, objective entities that were negative outside the domain of human consciousness, which I agree with. But
and vice versa.
The shift of eon, the new consciousness level of the universe, the domain that we inhabit, is so high that lower spectrum of negativity has 0% influence here now. All of the negativity that's influencing humanity at this time is originating within the consciousness of humans, period. It's no longer affected by those lower states associated with objective evil, if you will, or low energy or dark energy or bad energy, that because of the high energy of the universe itself. It's that was a curiosity to me that so prior to the eon shift, there was a connection between the lower astral realm of human consciousness and the more objective negativity.
Perhaps you should, because you know, we talked about this the other night, but you haven't really talked about it within this conversation, and for people who are just watching, maybe you should describe what you mean by the eon shift. Right, I know what you mean by it because we talked the other night and so forth, but this is really at the heart of your book in any event. So I know you're aware that I had some questions and they pertain to the account that you have given of the origin of the astral realm as essentially anthropic in character, that it begins with human beings and that it's specifically stimulated as a response to physical trauma induced by other human beings, that the violence of that creates the need for a sort of almost a split.
Indeed, that's perfect. Yep, dissociation.
And this differs from my understanding of this domain, and various ways. In part because I think that the astral is, it's connected to consciousness in a very primordial manner, so that with the birth of consciousness itself in the universe, you have coevally the establishment of the astral domain, which sort of, speaking loosely here, underlies the material. And as such, I don't see it as so specifically associated with human being. I think, for instance, a spider has an astral facet to its awareness, which is and so on and so forth, right? So I can see how one can retrench into the astral as a response to particularly upsetting experiences in the material plane, where we spend a good deal of our waking life. But I'm disinclined to analyze the function of the astral as merely a depository, or as predominantly a depository for unresolved traumatic emotionalities. So those are sort of the main concerns that I would bring to bear on the account that you have provided. It is also unclear to me whether we can really designate so relatively specific a date is 1.4 million years or something like that, as being when we come into the picture definitively, right? Like, well, that's when human beings really get into the astral game, is 1.4 million years ago. You seem to be suggesting that there were historical events that unfolded at that time, which occasioned that emergence. Perhaps you could say more as to how one would come to arrive at that conclusion or to know that.
It's just as simple as using the muscle test and being creative with the questions that you ask. At the same time, maintaining a certain level of precision so that you don't get a false positive. So if you ask the muscle test, there was an event 1.5 million years ago that informed the creation of the astral realm of human consciousness as a, you know, strata in the overall human consciousness, you would get a no. If you changed it to 1.4 million years, you'd get a yes.
That it was really, go on.
Yeah, this was the whole technique in discerning the periods of time where the eons of consciousness changed, and it was evident that a wave, that consciousness was emanating forth from the unmanifest as a waveform. There's a part of a graph on my website that shows this waveform over the last 12,000 years. It's an eccentric waveform with a gently increasing trend line. So what we did was we went back at certain intervals and asked the muscle test, well, what was the consciousness level of the universe, you know, whatever, 1,000 years ago? What was it 2,000 years ago? Of course, we didn't use questions, we used declarative statements. So we would say the consciousness level of the universe 1,000 years ago was 150. And we would get yes, it was 160, yes, 170, yes, 180, yes, 190 would go weak. So, and then we would use precision to pinpoint exactly what the level of consciousness was. And it turned out to be, I think in that period of time, 180. We made a graph, the graph's available on my website.
So what does that number mean? And I know that the scale has an arbitrary quality to it, just like any scale does at a point, you know, like Fahrenheit and Celsius, the division of degrees is arbitrary, but it's still, there's a correlation between those numbers and molecular excitation in the atmosphere in general, or whatever it is whose temperature you're measuring. So what is being measured about consciousness? Like, what is more pronounced at consciousness, which tracks as 300 on the Hawkins scale, as opposed to 180 or 1,000? What is the variance being indexed there?
First of all, the scale, as you said, goes from 0 to 1,000, with 1 being the lowest form of consciousness in the entire universe, which would be equivalent to an amoeba and a life expression, all the way to the top, which would be 1,000, which would be the avatars of the last few millennia: Jesus Christ, Krishna, Buddha, Zoroaster, etc. They would have been the avatars that all religions are based out of, turned out to be the highest conscious, the beings that ranked the highest on the consciousness scale. So let's take the two examples that you talked about. What Hawkins discovered was that every human emotion, every human state of consciousness could be calibrated. So, you know, happiness and joy could be placed on the scale at the level of 500 or 540, somewhere in the 500s. Reason, the intellect, thinking, was the region of the 400s. Willingness, acceptance, grit, doingness was the level of the 300s. 200s were the level of neutrality. And right at the level of 200 was a threshold that determined whether consciousness was positive, life-supporting, nurturing, powerful over whether it was life-denying, negative, and destructive. 200, there was a threshold what he discovered. Everything below 200 is what's associated with, I hate to use this word, what's associated with, you know, cardinal shortcomings, we'll say, pride, desire, greed, anger, fear. All of those striations of consciousness have a numeric value. The scale in and of itself is logarithmic. So the higher you go, the higher the energy of the state of consciousness is. At the very bottom of the scale are shame and guilt and depression, grief. As you get into the middles, like I said, you have fear, desire, anger, pride. And then right at the threshold of 200, you go over into courage and telling the truth. Anybody who's ever known an alcoholic who got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous knows that they go from those lower levels of consciousness, all of a sudden they jump into the higher realms. And what is the first step in AA? They told the truth. They got honest with themselves. They faced the truth. That is courage. That's the level of 200. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. We admitted it. So they, through that admitting, through self-honesty, they jump over the threshold into the higher domain. So that interestingly is the threshold. It's truth, the ability to tell the truth, the ability to be honest. That is the beginning point of all higher consciousness.
So what is, so the just trying to think. So then in turn, well, we can jump ahead in a second to the connection between the consciousness of an individual and societal consciousness and intervening levels there. Energy, right? Energy then is associated with emotional states that are broadly considered more positive, such as love, compassion, what have you, right?
Right.
And the predicate of accessing those higher degrees of energetic experience is a positive relationship with the truth.
Yes, it's a matter of being self-honest, of being capable of being honest, of truth, and of acknowledgement of the truth. Yeah.
Right. So one implication of tying that to a sort of relative energy is that not all people are in a position to access the truth at a given moment. Is that an implication? If it is, I gotta confess a level of discomfort with it, but I'm just asking by way of clarification.
The answer is that was the condition of the universe prior to August 22nd, 2023. That there were indeed a huge segment of the population that was largely unwilling or incapable of fundamental basic honesty.
But what you're saying then in the book, and this I guess is a segue, what you're saying in the book is that by hook or by crook, we are at a different stage where now the ambient available energy is such that all are capable of accessing the truth if they are so inclined.
Indeed, indeed.
And this was your discovery, if I understand correctly, Right. Or what I shouldn't say, your specific discovery, I guess, if I hear you correctly, on a personal level, you finding this process vis-a-vis David Hawkins catalyzed certain other insights and has a kind of moment in your personal history. But then there is the additional discovery that happened again, almost as it were accidentally, that it seems that the overall energy of the universe has seen a movement upward, which then suggests that we are on the cusp of a different, even existentially distinct historical interval.
There's no doubt.
And maybe I just ask you to elaborate on that.
Okay.
Or maybe that's not a sufficiently focused question. I could ask this question, which is kind of a challenging question. How do you reconcile, on the one hand, this perception that we are on the cusp of a new, more conscious age with the state of affairs in the world in general,
Yeah.
which hardly seems consistent with an elevated consciousness? Let me ask you that question, because I'm sure
Sure.
you've encountered it in one variation or another and
Sure.
have a response to it.
Indeed, it was first encountered right in myself because I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And I thought, why aren't people, walking in the streets holding hands? And singing and joyful and all that stuff. There's a period of entrainment that takes place. So the consciousness level has gone up, but all the remnants of the repressed content of the psyche that made up the human ego is still there. And so what's happening is that the overall energy field has changed, but it's going to require a period of time to entrain consciousness to that level. It happens by the phenomenon of entrainment. So it's almost as if all of the baggage, all of that negativity will be brought up to be processed to this new level. And basically you could make, I mean, it would be reasonable to expect that things might even get worse before they get better, because all of that is going to be brought up to be healed, to be processed, and to be brought to the light, if you will. I think that what we'll see in terms of conflict in the world is the expression of long-standing conflicts that are now being coming to a head, and that things may actually get worse before they get better.
Now, I guess I might ask how you see the relationship of this is drawing it down. Well, I'll save that question for just a moment. I feel like the we have to engage the question of inevitability, right? Is this something which is inevitable, or is it the outcome or consequence of decisions to be made on the part of us as individuals? To what extent, excuse me, oh my goodness, pardon me, to what extent is this entrainment something with which we have to choose to participate?
We've already chosen. That's the thing, is that the leap upwards in consciousness that happened unexpectedly back in August was an expression of the spiritual will of humankind, the collective spiritual will, that over these eons of consciousness, that the collective consciousness has been doing work. They've been on a certain level, spiritually speaking, the universe is evolving. It's moving forward, and collectively, the spiritual human consciousness has been trying to accumulate merit to leap into a higher state. So, I mean, it's not like something we talked about that was spoken, that was, that we agreed upon, that that's all ego stuff. That's all, that's the ego talking. This is the deeper spiritual will of humankind that operates deeply within everyone. And that decision was already made. That to the fact that the universal eon emerged and it was so high in consciousness is just evidence that collectively, as a spiritual species, we've made a decision to heal, to get better, to raise our consciousness. So the answer is that yes, the decision is being made collectively to go up. That's the reason that it went up in the first place. Is there going to be resistance? That's an understatement. That's a real understatement. Anybody who's ever tried to overcome a shortcoming in their personal life can attest to that. Yeah, how hard is it to overcome anger when you're angry at somebody? It's really hard. In fact, if you don't change the way that you look at somebody, you can't really forgive them. You can't really overcome anger. The change has to happen at the level of perception before it can be felt as a healing in your emotions. You have to look at the person differently. That is what Jesus said, you know, you that you have to perceive the innocence in the other person, realize that they're acting out some programming in their mind, you know, that perhaps is not personal. And maybe in the instances where it is personal, you know, that's an instance to look at maybe karma or something like that, or a relationship, you know, what was my part in that? No one, it's very difficult for the ego to own its part in its own dysfunctional relationships. It's blame is a huge aspect of keeping that whole matrix of suffering and pain in place. So, so I think there is collective agreement. It's not being communicated as such, but it's, the evidence is there in the, if you try to measure and calibrate the energy of the universe at one, you know, one day, it was at the level of pride, basically 180. And the next day it was in the etheric realm of higher than anything that was ever measured by the antecedents of the technique, Dr. Hawkins, namely.
I suppose then to round it out, I'm going to ask you the question I was holding as to how you see the relationship of digital technologies to this process, things like so-called AI and virtual modalities and so forth. How do you see the relationship of those technologies to this process?
I see AI as I don't actually see it in any way. I'm largely unfamiliar with it. I asked about it because we stumbled over the topic by chance during consciousness research muscle testing. We had discovered that at certain turning points during these eons of the universe, there was often an accompanying leap in technology, whether the technology was negative. For instance, in the Iron Age, when they first started using iron for weaponry, or as opposed to like the, the bow and arrow, or, you know, the discovery of fire, or things that were supportive to the health and well-being of Homo sapiens, as opposed to being destructive. So I was curious about what would this new, because there was always one in all the eons we looked at, there seemed to be this accompaniment of a technology, a new technology that came up. And AI was suggested by my daughter as possibly a new hallmark of a technological revolution that was going to unfold for humankind. Now, I am not a savvy person with this, and it was certainly completely large. I've seen it in the headlines and whatnot, but only started researching it after we discovered this during our testing sessions. What we found out was that AI is being used currently for almost 100% negative motives I think we, if I looked at the book again, it's like half of AI is used for overtly malignant reasons to try to influence people's perception on the internet, to try to malign others, to deceive others. But it has this, it has the technological promise to be a tool that was extremely positive for humans in the future. So that's about as far as I went with AI. I didn't really, I'm most concerned about it as because it seems like such a powerful tool to deceive people and a powerful tool to sow negativity. But at the same time, if it could be harnessed for good, it could be a new form of technology that would benefit us. I think there's another whole question to AI, and that is looking at it from the perspective of consciousness itself, which is, I think it's to me just plainly obvious that AI can never become fully conscious like a human could be conscious, that it will always depend on some level of human consciousness, programming it, setting it up, whatever, writing the programs that make it operate. Now, what's the critical factor there is what is the level of consciousness of the human who programs it? That's the most important question with AI. And is it benefiting everyone? Is the intention there the well-being of humankind as opposed to sowing chaos and personal gain, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, for my part, I am pretty dour with respect to the technology itself, because number one, it's really not especially novel. What you have is a vocabulary, which is clothing, or a process, essentially, of statistical analysis at a higher rate of speed, which is facilitated by contemporary computing to, produce probabilistic results. That's what's going on with so-called AI. It's really just brute calculation, refined by certain statistical processes. So, when you take off the clothing, it's not all that sexy. It's kind of remarkable that, given the fact that even in its most sophisticated articulations, it's relatively crude, and despite that crudity, it can at times produce interesting findings. That being said, I think it's almost wholly pejorative, almost wholly negative, largely because what you have is the installation of a counterfeit intelligence. I don't even like calling it a counterfeit intelligence, because it's not intelligence. It's a counterfeit mode of content generation, which then leads to the atrophy of active human intelligence. And this is straightforward. I mean, people going to things like ChatGPT to have them, to have it supplement or just do their homework and things like that, right? On one level, that seems like just like a trivial kind of abuse, but it speaks to the fundamental, I don't know, I never know where to look at my bloody cell phone when I'm doing these things. the camera and so forth. But I just see him. I have my profile there. And I go, oh my gosh, it looks ridiculous. But on one level, examples of people using these kinds of software to do, well, like look at art, for example, right? The whole idea of using these modalities to inform your artistic production, I find, frankly, very problematic. You can integrate digital products into your art, fine, yeah, fine, whatever, okay. But at the end of the day, I think that you are compromising your relationship with the artistic process by lending so much of it over to a machine. And I don't care what your medium is, whether it's painting or music or film. There needs to be embodiment. You need to have a corporeal relationship with your art. And these kinds of softwares serve to undermine that corporeality in a way which I think could potentially be fatal. The saving grace is that we have bodies and we can't escape the fact that we have bodies. And the inescapable fact of our flesh is, I think, what will ultimately emancipate us from this ridiculous preoccupation with the virtual. That's me talking, right? You know, so that's my position on the matter. So, which actually leads to another question, and that would be, and maybe we can leave it for another chat, and like as an opening question for another chat, and that is like, what is the significance of the body, right? The fact that we are embodied to our human being.
The body is the vehicle for consciousness. It is insentient and without consciousness. And it can be disidentified from totally. You are able to, you know, if you stop calling your sense perceptions of the body me and mine, you experience higher consciousness almost instantly, because that's sort of a core illusion that goes back all the way to the Buddha, that the belief that I am the body is a core belief that blocks the higher realms of consciousness of spiritual development. I see it as really a challenge to overcome identification with it, and in the long term to overcome the fear with its destruction, with its harm, to see it as a gift and something to be enjoyed. But not that I think that consciousness and the body are completely separated, that consciousness continues without the body, and can it be your experience, period, is not dependent on the physical body. Sense perceptions may be, but sense perceptions are experienced within consciousness itself. So I don't put a lot of attention there. Some spiritual teachings do, and some spiritual teachings are completely based around disidentification from the body. I can say from personal experience that one of the most powerful health measures that I've ever taken was disidentifying from my physical form and identifying with awareness, with consciousness itself. And the power that has to basically erase a lot of the belief systems that are associated with the body and protecting it, taking care of it, maintaining it, and all the things that we're taught to do. You know, I mean, of course, that isn't something that I've mastered, but my health is so much better than it has ever been And part of the course of spiritual discipline that I went through previous to discovering encountering the eon shift was disidentification from the body. At a certain point of spiritual aspiration, you have to let go of your attachment to bodily sensations in order to investigate the deeper realms within. So
I'm not so certain at this point about that narrative, which does show up through various spiritual traditions with a consistency. But we are now sort of in a domain where we're dealing with somewhat subtle matters. You could say that there is the notion of disidentifying with the body as the body is conceived by, we could call it, egoic consciousness. But I feel that actually fully being with one's body is actually of immense significance, or at least has the power to be one pathway towards realization, if you like. And in part because the body is a very effective instrument of discernment, as is noted by your own harnessing of this process of musculature testing. So most of us don't really live in our bodies. Most of us are constantly out of our bodies and abstracted by distractions, stimulated by screens and other matters. I don't actually think we necessarily disagree. It's just a matter of refining the language that we are employing. There's like two difficulties that arise. Both of them are associated with a kind of spiritual materialism. One is the undue prioritization of certain states of mind, bliss states, states of insight, right? If you become excessively identified with those states, it actually undermines their significance. And then instead of those states becoming emancipatory, they can lead to a deeper, even more dangerous bondage. The other apprehension, that's actually somewhat distinct from this question of our relationship with the body. But the other thing I bring it up in connection with this latter point for some reason, which is escaping me, but which will hopefully reassert itself momentarily. The other reason I think it's necessary to prioritize our relationship with the corporeal, the physical, is that things like transhumanism, I feel, are asking questions or are compelling people to a disfigured relationship with their own reality. You know, you get these perverse suggestions, something that like, oh, well, we can upload our consciousness into a machine. That's sort of the abstraction, right? You know, we're laughing about it, but there are people who are very serious about going down that line, you know, or replacing as much of the human organism with synthetic counterparts and so-called neuro implants and what have you, and all this stuff. This is a path that is being presented, and I feel is putting us out of touch with our own humanity. And I also think that the confusion, which is ascendant in discourses, conversations around gender, is additionally an expression of this problematized relationship with the body. I think that being in a body then entails being in a specific body, which has a specific sex in the vast majority of instances. And it's a complicated matter because sex is distinct from gender, but I don't think we can completely disaggregate those terms. You can't completely extricate the one from the other. I don't have a solution, but it doesn't seem that the current conversations around these matters has any convincing solutions either. I guess I'm just raising that more as a concern. I don't have anything conclusive to suggest or assert at this time. So we should probably wrap it up here, even though it's all very open-ended. And that's kind of tangential there toward the end. So let me turn it over to you if you want to try and add any sort of resolving comments before we wrap it up for today, Tim.
Well, in the conclusion of the book, I see it as a very hopeful place for humankind to be at, and that, you know, within a few centuries, if not one century, that the eon will be recognized in retrospect that, you know, I can sit here and say that this is unfolding and demonstrate it with the muscle test and all that stuff. But until it's, you know, a new reality in the world, it's sort of just an observation, I suppose, at this point. I did offer some suggestions in terms of one thing that we didn't talk about were the animal archetypes and the discussion on the psyche in the book. And that's the portion of the book that offers a different perspective on spiritual growth and some suggestions on how to contextualize repressed emotions and subpersonalities, aggregates of emotions that manifest as certain styles of behavior in problematic portions of our lives. I think if anybody is interested in that, to look at the animal archetypes section of the book. I think that's really actually where a lot of the value is for people, because it really talks about the blocks to higher states of consciousness as specific archetypal emotional aggregates that each one of us has.
So let me interrupt you to suggest that we just do another conversation in a week or so, and in that time we can look at that stuff more explicitly than today. So
I would love to. I really enjoy talking with you. I wish we could do it over in person and
be the real world, right? So the enfleshed reality.
Such a pleasure to catch up with you.
Right back at you, Mr. Benson. You know, back in the day, Tim and I and Tim Connolly and some other fellows, you know, but we had some good times. So, but I guess we'll wrap it up for today. At that moment, but like you said, Tim, it's been good catching up. Talking about this, this is the stuff to talk about. What else is there to discuss, right? And these kinds of things. And we'll have a follow-up conversation here in a few days.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much, Tom, for inviting me.
Right back at you, man. You have a good night.
Okay, thank you. All the best.
All right. Ciao for now.